Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's Mad Tech podcast. I'm Rachel Smith, COO of ExchangeWire, and today here in the studio we've got a very special guest, Ruth Zora. Did I pronounce that right, Ruth?
That is right.
Amazing.
As good as it gets in English. Yes.
Thank you very much. And Ruth is Global Lead for BBVA at Mindshare. So delighted to have you here with us today, Ruth. And, of course, we've got ExchangeWire's Head of Content, Lindsay Roundtree, back in the hot seat. Hi, Lindsay. How's it going over there?
Hi, really well, thank you.
Excellent. So let's dive into the first news story of the week. First up, I wanted to talk about an article that appeared in Business Insider earlier this week, which was focusing on the French government's intention to tax big tech companies like Google, Facebook and Amazon on the revenue that they make locally. Right, so the proposal that's currently being drafted to form some legislation that they're looking to pass through at the moment would apply to companies with global annual revenue over 750 million euro and annual revenue over 25 million euro in France. And the intention is to tax them 3% of that revenue. Now, the UK were looking at proposing something similar, which was announced in a sort of budget announcement by the Chancellor late last year, which is looking to apply a 2% tax on British user-generated revenue to the same sort of suite of big tech companies. And in both cases, you know, UK and French governments are looking to collect something in the region of 400 million sterling, or about 500 million euro in taxes. So, you know, obviously this is a big play on behalf of governments to look at taxing big tech companies. And it's kind of probably not going to feel like news, really, because this has been something that European governments have been talking about for quite some time. It was also interesting that the French finance minister sort of came out quite strongly in his quotes to the media, saying that he felt that this was a step forward for justice, that these are companies that make an enormous amount of revenue off using our personal data and don't necessarily pay their fair share of tax. But, you know, tax is always a controversial topic. So I'm interested to hear what you both make of this. Ruth, let's go to you first.
Well, for me, it's interesting the timing in which this is coming out. Obviously, there's the sociopolitical situation in France recently hasn't been easy, particularly for Macron. And I think there is an element of appeasing the masses with this proposal, trying to generate more revenue that could potentially go into other types of programs, perhaps social programs. There's no real detail behind how that revenue is going to be spent. Mm. What for me is interesting is not so much that the regulation will be out there, that they'll try to tax companies more aggressively, but is whether this is enforceable, which is at the end of the day what matters in this type of environment. And we've seen, you know, companies of all sizes, but certainly the big four being incredibly successful at exploiting the loopholes in tax laws to be able to save as much money as possible and be the profitable companies that they are today. So I think with this effort, there has to be an infrastructure that makes the collection of said taxes enforceable. And I would argue, you know, in the European Union, a joint consensus in terms of the different countries that are involved to be able to execute this successfully. Because as long as there exist safe havens elsewhere and the money can be rerouted, it will be very difficult to enforce such tax laws.
And you just wind up shunting sort of, you know, one arrangement onto another safe haven in another European country. Lindsay?
Yeah, I mean, the problem we have here is the island factor, right?
Because
it is
Switzerland.
And Switzerland too. Yes. But I mean, they are, if you think about a lot of the big tech companies they're talking about taxing, a lot of them are HQ'd in Ireland. And there was a block on a similar kind of EU level proposal last year to tax these big companies. And Ireland were kind of shaking a little bit, going, oh my God, we're going to have no money left at the end of this. Mm. And they banded together and managed to block it because actually that level of, it's Ruth, exactly what you were saying about loopholes. I mean, either we do it at a market level or we do it at a kind of region level.
Exactly.
If we do it at a region level, we're going to impact massively the tax havens of Ireland, Luxembourg, Switzerland, everything else. But if we do it at a local level, people will still find loopholes and they'll just move it somewhere else. And actually, it could end up hurting our neighbour countries more and moving it out of Europe completely. I don't think it will be enforced, as you say, it won't be enforceable.
Exactly.
Yeah. I can't see how it'd be enforceable.
And let's not forget as well that a lot of the incentives that governments have to provide said loopholes to these companies is because they do generate a lot of jobs for those markets, right? I would venture, I guess, that Dublin would look very different today had it not offered the concessions that it offered to some of these companies to establish their headquarters there. So there is a quid pro quo in this scenario that is important in terms of revenue generation for the individuals in those markets that have access to these jobs that wouldn't otherwise be there and that the government would have to find ways to generate themselves. So it's an interesting exchange, I would say.
Actually, frankly, if you look at those companies as employers in the UK, without them, there would be a significant like loss within London specifically, the volumes they're employing, the amount of money they're actually spending in the market. Take that away and tax them. They'll go, fine, we'll move the jobs elsewhere. They will do things. We'll be cutting our nose to spite our face in some way or another.
The other thing is, you know, we were talking about that just prior to this session, we're talking about in the office. You know, countries that we're specifically talking about here, like the UK and France, doing something about their own already existing tax loopholes? Because actually, if the taxation system in the UK was better, then, you know, Google and Facebook and Amazon would be paying more tax here just as it is anyway. So it's not just a matter of setting up a separate sort of, you know, a special taxation and then trying to enforce that. It's also a matter of looking at your existing system, never mind what your neighbouring countries such as Ireland and other tax havens might be doing, looking at your existing system and trying to close down the loopholes that already exist there. The other thing that I was wondering, though, is this perhaps the start of just trying to find, for European countries, just trying to find a way of kind of sending the message to big tech companies that, you know, we're watching you. We're not comfortable with you just doing what you want, when you want, using people's personal data however you want, coming up with really pretty pathetic excuses around all of the controversies that have surrounded you over the last couple of years as justifications for why you operate the way that you do. We don't feel that you contribute enough to the public purse. Yes, you generate obviously lots of jobs and employment, and you're, you know, fast moving, fast growing, big commercial innovative companies, but there's got to be some kind of balance here. Do you think it's an attempt and an effort to do that, since, you know, arguably they're not being challenged in that way at all in the US? I mean, you know, there might be people that want to challenge them in that way, but I think there's a common thought. Scott Galloway's been saying that for quite a while, you know, the people that are going to slow down the sort of, you know, exponential growth and domination of these big tech companies are in Europe. It's not going to happen in America. Do you think this is a step towards that?
I think we can't leave aside the tension between global and local. And the reason I bring it up is because these companies are operating at a global level. Most of the laws that they are being held to are developed at a local level. And so I think we fundamentally have an imbalance in how the operations meet reality, right, when it comes to the local laws. And until that is resolved, and until we start thinking about perhaps more globalized frameworks, there's nothing stopping them from moving from one local market to another, as we've just discussed, right? Mm. And I think there is a lot of value generation that these companies bring for the local entities, for the countries. You can talk about jobs, you can talk about education, aspiration, social mobility. I mean, there's a whole set of things that are good for the country to have their presence in. And so for me, I think what we need to start thinking about is a way in which we can generate more cohesion in terms of the tax structures and more enforceability, therefore, to be able to deal with what we're dealing with, which is global companies. Because what this will end up doing, you know, Macron's proposal, you'll have French firms that operate predominantly in France, you know, in that 25 to, I think, 750 million range that are going to be the ones really bearing the costs of such law. So I think it's an interesting element that I don't think the article captures and that we haven't really discussed.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, actually, that you know, actually the way that it's being proposed to be applied, you know, as ever, I suppose we sort of had these conversations around GDPR as well, didn't
exactly.
we?
Mm.
Is that the biggest companies with the biggest workforce and the biggest army of lawyers and smart accountants will be able to work their way around it, and actually it will be the smaller companies who are also generating huge amounts of revenue, but that will be really penalised by this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Criteo is an interesting point here, because Criteo would fall into that category, and they are a darling of the French ad tech scene. They float on the French stock exchange. Actually, if the government were to do anything that could harm them and their status within France and their status globally, I think that Criteo would have something to say about it. And I don't think they would want to annoy Criteo. So I do believe that actually there could be some conversations had around there as to how can we make this work for the non-local companies. And as you said, Ruth, it's the local versus global. So if you are kind of, if you're HQ'd locally and you're on our stock exchange, you won't get touched by this. But if you do happen to have over 25 million euros of revenue in our country and you aren't based in our country, then you will get fined. Mm. But again, it goes back to what we were saying a few weeks ago, kind of from a UK perspective as well, which is the challenge around self-regulation of these companies. And it's these global companies that are able to just kind of like come into these individual markets, all guns blazing, and do whatever they like. And the comment that the report that recently came out of the UK government was that Facebook, for example, are digital gangsters. Mm. And we can't go on with them being able to self-regulate themselves in our market, but we have not got the resource to be able to regulate them ourselves anyway. So it's kind of rock and a hard place. What do you do? What's your next move? And the next move, I don't think, is to go, we're going to tax you a ton of money and annoy you even more.
Yeah. And, you know, I wonder if it's another example of, and in fact, I think we talked about this, didn't we, on the Mad Tech podcast where we were speaking about the digital gangsters article. Is it another example of lawmakers and politicians kind of not quite understanding the nuances within the industry that relates to the piece of legislation or the kind of legislative control they're wanting to exercise here? So actually, you know, and let's remind ourselves, this is just draft legislation at the moment. Let's see how far it actually goes, because it's going to be debated, obviously, amongst MPs in Parliament in France and also in the UK, although, you know, it's obviously not what the UK Parliament are focusing on at the moment. I wonder what else they're busy doing.
I mean, they're just twiddling their thumbs, I think, at the moment.
So. But, you know, when it comes back around, there'll obviously be lots of debates. You know, is it the case that we're in the hands of people that don't necessarily really understand what they're putting in place? I'm not meaning to suggest they can't grasp it, but it's complex, and you know, it's not just about how you tax and how you regulate big commercial companies. It's about how you do that in a digital environment, in this digital age, with all of the digital assets that these companies have got. Is it another example of that?
Yeah, they can't grasp it. Actually, Australia is an interesting example here, where they are, I mean, I don't know the exact details, but the government is trying to introduce a tax on the likes of Google and Facebook, but there's a tax on basically every single bid. So you have a fee, a charge on top of every single bid. So it's real time. So if, say, an advertiser pays $1, then there'll be a tax on top of that that would then go back to the likes of Google and Facebook, and they would pay that tax to the government. And that is their way of getting more tax out of them, where they are shirking tax in other areas. Now, I'm not saying that's the answer, and it's a bit of a funny one. And as I said, I don't know the full details, but that's an interesting alternative, an interesting way of looking at it, that's just understanding Google and Facebook business models more and how we can work with them to make the most out of what their model is and what they're how they're using us as consumers and us as a nation.
Yeah, much more nuanced proposal, put it that way. Yeah.
I mean, I believe it was towards the end of 2018, the Economist did a series of articles on taxation and questioning whether our existing tax laws are right for the type of environment that we live in today. Mm. There is an element of digitization coming in to change and to disrupt the way in which we operate as societies, and therefore a potential need, right, to actually evolve those systems as well. And so I do think there's a big question mark as to whether taxes as we know them today are effective, and whether we can actually use this as an opportunity to evolve what is a system that has been taken pretty much as the default system across the globe, right?
Yeah.
And that clearly isn't working, because in many cases you can't actually collect set taxes successfully.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing, probably be worth watching it from a higher level, understanding how tax itself is going to
is evolving. Yeah. That's a whole other conversation and podcast, I reckon. Okay, so moving on to the second story for the week. This is about an article that appeared on the news site 2PM earlier this week, focusing on the presence of DTC brands at the trade show Shop Talk in Vegas earlier on the week. And the article was outlining that there were in their opinion less obvious presence from DTC brands this year than there had been in the previous year, noting that, of course, a couple of those is as a result of acquisitions, Walmart buying Bonobos and Unilever having bought Dollar Shave Club, Nordstrom buying Trunk Club as well as an example of that. But it was also, I also thought this was interesting because it's connected to a DTC conversation we were having last week about what it is that legacy brands can be teaching DTC brands, or the other way around. What is it that DTC brands are wanting to sort of glean from the experience of legacy brands? And it seemed to me that there's a conversation to be had here about the degree to which DTC brands can look to challenger brands to be learning lessons around scale and building brand and, truly kind of expanding. And that also this particular article was drawing on some examples of those DTC brands that had either been acquired by larger shopfront stores or CPGs, having therefore then gained access either to shopfronts for, creating some kinds of, interactive shopper experience, or gaining access to, sort of real estate within bigger stores that they wouldn't necessarily have had before, which is, of course, considered more traditional routes to connect with customers. So I just thought this was a really interesting article off the back of last week's chat. Really interested to know what you both think about that, because there's just, we're spending so much time talking about DTC brands and their relationships with legacy brands. It feels as though those two worlds are kind of coming a little closer together, and that DTC brands are learning quite a lot off legacy brands, and that legacy brands are using those challenger brands to acquire customers in different areas. So Ruth, I'm going to go to you first, because I know, this is a bit of an area of interest for you in general anyway. So what do you think about this?
Yeah, I love this article. Obviously, in my time at Mindshare in the UK, we did quite a bit of work through Grow to work with these type of brands and helping them understand how they could partner with an established agency like us to start investing in more quote-unquote traditional media, precisely to get that reach and to start building brand in a different way to what they know and they do on a day-to-day basis. And I think it's fascinating. I think it's fascinating because there is this, and I will say it, misunderstanding that DTC brands go straight to consumer. They market to them in a very performance led way, and they continue to grow by magic like that. And it's not true. At some point, they will hit diminishing returns, and at some point, they will need to start creating more of a market for their products. And at that point in time, that's when most of them shift to start investing in brand, to start taking perhaps a more traditional media mix into account, so that they can generate that mental awareness and availability with consumers, and through that then generate greater throughput into their own acquisition channels. We've certainly seen it very tangibly with one of our clients there. I can't disclose the name, but I can tell you that when we started working with them, I know, it's a real shame. I know.
We always like a bit of disclosure.
I'm terribly sorry. But there'll be a familiar brand, amongst the group that you've just mentioned. And actually being able to track how those curves evolve is fascinating, because legacy brands seldom have that luxury. They've been present for so long that either those curves have flattened or there's far too much noise to be able to measure it correctly. And so when you're able to do it from scratch with a DTC brand, like the ones that you've mentioned in this article, it's phenomenal to see that interplay of brand and performance, which I think has been a standard that has been around for so long that we've taken for granted in some spaces.
Interesting. Lindsay?
Yeah, I completely agree with all of that. And I think, Ruth, you're talking about misconceptions around kind of what DTs are and why they do what they do. I mean, it's a lot of them, obviously, they're very, very canny. They're very shrewd in their processes and their strategies. But many of them started out, doing things in their front rooms, and they were like, oh, I need to advertise this. Where do I go? And the obvious choice is always going to be Facebook ads and Google paid search. They are the obvious things that are literally set up for small to medium-sized enterprises. And Google and Facebook do a great job of courting those kinds of businesses. And also Amazon as well. We can't ignore Amazon for this too, of actually helping them grow. And they are then going to reach critical mass. They are then going to reach the point of diminishing returns. And then they go, okay, what do I need to do next? And they'll look to what the legacies have been doing and how the legacies have grown all those years. And they have massive reach. They have a brand. They get to a stage where they've done all they can kind of in the obvious acquisition mm-hmm. sense. And they go, okay, I'm doing really well from a sales perspective, but actually no one really knows what my brand is and what my brand stands for. Now I need to go down the branding route. Mm. And then the obvious choices there would be the out of home. Audio is another popular one. I listen to a lot of podcasts. I'm hearing a lot of DTC yeah. brands on there as well. And linear TV. But largely they're going for out of home, traditional out of home, linear TV, because they're actually cheaper than the digital versions. Connected TV is still quite debilitating and quite it's a lot of barrier to entry for a lot of smaller brands that don't have a proof of concept yet. They might have the data, but they want the data, so they go linear TV because it's slightly cheaper. They can understand what they're doing. And the same with out of home as well. You only really see the big brands going for digital out of home, but the out of home, like on the London Underground in London, is actually still quite
full
cheap.
Of DTC yeah, brands.
They're
yeah,
absolutely yeah. everywhere, and it does really well for them. And it's, you know, fair play to them. And you know, we're speaking to a lot of DTC brands at the moment, and they're starting that journey of going, I need to build my brand now. This is where I'm seeing competitors go. You can spot them a mile off because they're always very colourful versus the more legacy brands that always use some kind of offer with discount codes in them. Like they're very, very different in the way they approach it, but actually it works. But I also think that there's a lot. The article was interesting, but the article did sort of say that actually DTCs aren't all that. They've still got a lot to learn from legacy brands. And actually, a lot of them just operate in a completely different microcosm almost. And maybe they don't need to be at ShopTalk because actually ShopTalk represents kind of an old style of retail that they're not yeah. actually involved in anymore. And maybe they don't need to be there to be bought by P&G and Unilever. Maybe they're going down a different route.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to be said. It's kind of one-sided from the, oh, DTCs are failing, but actually yeah.
we're not seeing so many no. of them at Shopify this year. Yeah. What does that mean?
I mean, yeah. it doesn't mean a whole lot.
No.
Because there's a lot more places they are going to, and there's a lot more areas where they are being courted, and maybe the likes of ShopTalk and everything else aren't where they need to be.
Perhaps
and
they're just busy selling products to people.
Maybe they are. And yeah. them going and them opening up storefronts like Allbirds, for example, and Other Stories is a great example that's done that European wide. They're saying, see, they had to go down the old school route of opening up a shopfront. But actually, they grew to such a size, they were going, oh my God, we can open a physical store now. And we've got so much first party data, we can do it better than any legacy brand. That to me still spells like a really, really strong opportunities for them at the moment.
And, you know, very, and sort of opportunities that have come out of that entire DTC experience, yeah. right? And I was interested in that bit actually, because I was interested in the notion of, you know, what that's doing to the retail industry, into the high street store mm-hmm. sort of side of retail, because you're quite right. It's not that we're not seeing DTC brands anywhere in any stores ever. We are in certain places, either a store of their own or a pop-up or some kind of store shopfront experience or within somebody else's store. And you can see that people are responding to that really well in general, because they've used the data that they've got to sort of inform mm-hmm. those choices that they're making in terms of what they'll do, whether they'll, you know, where they might open up a pop-up or where they might sort of target. And is that another opportunity for the high street? We keep hearing about the death of high street shopping. Is this going to change things for the high street, or do you still think the high street's on its way out?
I think for me, it is very dependent on the type of product yeah. that these companies are selling, right? Yeah. Some products lend themselves better to the physical space. And for those, you know, perhaps having a physical presence in a high street or something along those lines may be the right approach. For others, it may be fine to just do it as a 100% digital process. And I think this is what we need to take into account, that historically, perhaps the high street was the only place and the only manifestation of retail, right? Today, that's not the case. We have both physical as well as virtual manifestations of the retail space. Mm-hmm. And I think it will be very much dependent on the consumers and their consumption habits and how comfortable they feel. You know, some people like to try shoes on, right? For those, maybe having a pop-up is the right thing. Some are completely happy just getting them ordered into their house and then using a return service if they don't fit. every individual has slightly different ways in which they like to shop. And I think, to your point around first party data, this is perhaps the one thing that DTCs have done well, that they've set up with more of an engineering framework and therefore have created vast repositories of data that they can then question to help them answer some of these questions, right? Mm-hmm. And for me, that's the key innovation in there. The fact that they're coming to market with a very customer-centric approach, that they're coming to market in a bootstrapping way, right? So they're not spending unnecessarily because they can't. They don't have the budgets, particularly at the early stages, prior to getting funding and proving that they have a product. And thirdly, that because of that, they've had to be incredibly smart about how they get to know their consumers. Mm. Now, what is interesting for them, and where we have seen some value come through from an agency like Mindshare, where we have vast amounts of research, is they will know their own consumers very well, but they don't know what they don't know. What I mean by that is they don't know what the growth audience is or what the growth consumer sets will be for them. And so they're being able to remove the blinkers, take a more peripheral view of the potential opportunity for them becomes really important. And that won't be given to you by first party data. At that point, you may need to experiment with something else, see if it works. And so entering a culture of test and learning, which they feel very comfortable with because that's how they develop product in most instances, is quite natural to them. And I think in there, you know, you start seeing things like the two placards, right? Things like the pop-up shops. And so it's more of that experimentation culture that I think it's building and which established companies actually find quite appealing.
So that's really interesting, Ruth, because I was just about to ask you, and what about the agency role in this, right? So we're led to believe that, you know, challenger brands and DTC brands don't rely on agencies quite so much. Legacy brands have much more of a long tradition of, you know, quite close working with the agencies. I think you've probably just answered that, but presumably it's that actually there is an awful lot that an agency can be doing for a DTC brand in terms of that audience extension that they wouldn't otherwise necessarily have access to without a bit of expertise.
Yeah, I think the role of the agency changes quite significantly. You know, we've seen it ourselves with Grow in the UK. They are not interested in a shiny PowerPoint that is perfectly designed. They want the raw data so they can question it themselves. They have armies of data scientists helping them do that, right? Or very technical people in the case of the really early stage startups. They want someone who can complement their skill set rather than come in and do the same thing. In most cases, they will do media buying in-house. They will log onto the platforms. They will buy their search campaigns. They will buy their Facebook campaigns. And they will do it quite well. And it's precisely because they're so connected to the overall business that they can react much better by having that there, right? So the role of the agency becomes completely different. The role of the agency is exactly what I've just said to you. You know, they are laser focused on delivering and selling product. The role for us has been, when we work with these businesses, to help them lift their head and look around for other opportunities. And so it's more of a consultancy type role. It requires us to understand their business just as deeply as they do, so we can actually open up those other opportunities for them. And it also helps us make use of the assets that, for perhaps more established brands, are already part and parcel of what they do, such as audience research tools, such as surveys, things along those lines that they won't grasp immediately from their day to day.
It looks like they're looking to be a bit more inspired and actually going to the agencies to be more inspired. And actually, historically, with the bigger brands, agencies have kind of stopped doing that kind of thing because the big brands don't want it or need it anymore. So you're focusing so much on performance and acquisition and kind of, and there's less about brand building. And actually, it's probably actually quite nice for the agencies now to be able to go back to what they used to be and work with brands to help them grow and scale through innovative ideas.
Yeah, they become really interesting clients. And I think I like to believe from the experiences that we've had that we learn from them as much as they learn from us, because they do push us to work at a very different pace, right? For them, time is money, literally. Every second they don't sell a product, that is actually a challenge, because they're working under very, very constrained resources in many cases, particularly at the early stages, you know, before they get Series B or Series C funding.
Yeah, great. Let's move on to story three, which is changing gears a little bit. I wanted to highlight a couple of articles actually that had appeared on AdExchanger this week. both focused on the world of audio and podcasts, in fact. The first was an article focusing on Spotify getting behind the growing popularity of podcast consumption and how they're using their programmatic advertising capabilities within that particular medium. The second article was focusing on how Google are trying to vie for podcast listeners and what they're actually implementing in order to get that share of audience. So the article about Google was talking about the native podcast app that they launched for Android last year and how they're looking to improve discovery through search and voice assistance, and that the search results are starting to get a lot more granular. So it's not just podcast suggestions that are being put forward, but it's actual links to specific parts of podcasts. They're also talking about the future of that being perhaps that you're Googling something like a definition of a particular term or a particular product or service, and what gets returned to you is an audio snippet. So the idea being that, you know, there is a vast amount of opportunity in an audio audience, and we haven't really realized those opportunities yet. Going back again to the Spotify article, of course, it was talking about their programmatic capabilities, but it was also talking about how important the podcast medium is to them and the results that they've been getting for some of their advertisers who are you know, using that medium and how successful it is. So I guess I wanted to talk about this in the context of emerging sort of programmatic channels, as we like to refer to. So out of home, audio, anything, I suppose, TV related, non-linear TV related. And I also wanted to talk about how this relates to sort of what appears to be a little bit of a race between Google and Spotify and perhaps other sort of mediums in the effort to, I suppose, get share of audio via search. I just thought that element to this story was quite interesting. Let's go the other way around this time. Lindsay, to you first.
Yeah, I do find this interesting. And I think because Google, when they launched their native podcast app, they didn't launch it in the UK initially, for example. They launched it early in Germany, and so we didn't see it for a while and didn't really know what was going on. But we have had the likes of Amazon actually with their Alexa, with their Echo, actually working really closely with other platforms like TuneIn, like Spotify, to get them to be able to promote their podcast, and not just the entire podcast series, but actually individual episodes through voice. So Google have probably been watching in the wings and wondering what's going on and how Amazon are doing it, and gone, that's quite good, we can make it better, let's give people actual snippets. Because what you don't really get when you're trying to find a podcast is actually a little snippet of it to understand if I'm going to enjoy it or not. So I think it's very, very smart, and going down the search route makes a lot of sense because that's what Google do so well. But they haven't necessarily got the voice search through a smart device aspect of things sorted yet, and I don't know how they're going to prioritize what information would be shown or shared when somebody searches something. And that's what I think will be interesting, because there's a lot of information within just one podcast, and if you're actually searching for something like best true crime podcast, anything could come up. Will you be showing a snippet? Will you be showing the entire series? Will you be showing one episode? What will they be using to match? Will they be using keywords within the metadata, the meta description of the podcast? Will they be using audio tags? I think there's a lot of information that we're not really sure about yet as to how it will actually work. I do find it interesting.
Yeah. Yep. Ruth?
I love podcasts. I think they're a phenomenal medium. And we've
excellent
done some
answer.
successful work with some of our brands in the past, you know, creating bespoke content series that are branded and that add some entertainment value to consumers. And I think this is the important piece, because I think, and I heard it recently as well, one of the Radiotopia shows had one of the sports brands do a snippet. I don't know if you've ever heard the podcast Everything is Alive. They use inanimate objects and they interview them as they would a human being. Mm, and they tell you brilliant. About their story, which is brilliant. And Adidas had a phenomenal idea that I wish we had done for one of our clients. So kudos to the creative agency there. They did a great job of using an Adidas shoe and actually interviewing the Adidas shoe as they had done with other objects in the podcast. Now, this is not something that you could do potentially programmatically, right? This is something that required a lot of planning.
Yeah.
And that becomes such a unique experience that I'm I've remembered it, and I'm telling you this today, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think there is a balance, just as we had it with other forms of programmatic media. There's a balance to strike. To know when it is okay to use programmatic for pushing the brand, and when it is much better to create some sort of sponsorship or partnership that is feels quite unique and that will get that throughput for you. So I'm not seeing that level of nuance here yet. Mm. And that worries me, because I think we're going to clutter the voice space as much as we did the early days of search, yeah, and display as, yeah, well. And so that worries me. I would say proceed with caution. The other piece is in terms of how people are actually using voice searches today, right? I don't know from your experience, but at least from mine, we've done a couple of analyses for some of our clients, and it's still very much in its early development stage. There's not a lot of people that are using voice search yet, I think, because they still need to get familiar with some of the assistants. But then when it happens, in most cases, the result is actually done on the screen. So you may be walking. It's easier for you to actually use voice search because you're on the move. But in reality, the output that you get is very much a list of SERPs, as you would have it's done visual, had you not, yeah, typed it, right? Mm. So I think we're starting to move into the space where we need to stop thinking about audio or video or visual, and actually think about that multi-sensory experience which will become more and more common for consumers, and what they will expect. Something to do with haptics, with sound, with visual imagery, and that coming together being the representation of the brand. And I think being able to codify that will become very, very important. I don't think many people are thinking about that.
Mm. No, I think a lot of podcast publishers, podcast creators are terrified of letting go of control of the advertising side of things as well. So a lot, yeah, of them still could, yeah, will run their own advertising. They will work with the partners directly. They won't go into down the programmatic route yet. So again, Ruth, as you said, there's definitely a balance to be had. And you might start seeing actual kind of publishers, a bit like you do in the sort of the game development space, publishers that will allow developers to run their games for their platform, so they can take on the ad insertion side of things,
yeah,
and manage it effectively, so the podcast creator hasn't got to worry about it. But you're not seeing many of those kind of on the kind of mainstream yet, and maybe that's something that like Spotify are trying to get into. I don't know, but it actually that could be interesting as well, because it will allow them to kind of have the best of both worlds and do the direct deal still, but also kind of have like an open market demand for programmatic audio.
Yeah, it feels very much like early days, as you've both said, and even, you know, in fairness to both of these articles, I think that we're both focusing on early experiments, yeah, early results.
I'd say yes and no, because Global has been doing this for quite some time now, yeah, right? Through DAX.
Yeah, very true.
And so I read this and I didn't know what to think of the article, because I didn't quite think that it was as innovative or as early days, right? Mm. Precisely because of that exposure that we've, yep, had, particularly in this market, and you've had it in Canada, the US as well, and, yeah, other parts of Europe too. And then equally, there was, as I've said, you know, like the branded experience piece that you do on audio today, I don't think it can be simplified as much as this article suggests.
Mm,
precisely because there's a lot of production that comes behind doing it well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That totally makes sense. I mean, you know, maybe, yeah, maybe people don't feel like they've got results worth speaking about just yet. I don't know. It's, yeah. Well, it's certainly one to watch and see. Okay, so moving on to the second part of the podcast, which is a bit more of a focus on you, Ruth. Tell us a bit. Yep, in the hot seat now. Tell us a bit about your role at Mindshare with BBVA, which is kind of newish or very new?
Yeah, quite new. I had worked predominantly in market in the UK. My last role with Mindshare in the UK was as chief product officer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you're thinking about what the future should look like from agency product and agency offerings, it is incredibly important to work directly with clients. And so I had this opportunity to work with BBVA in a space that I find fascinating. I think the world of retail banking is being turned upside down, and there's still a long way to go still. Talk about those D2C brands, right?
Yeah.
And so I just thought it would be fascinating to have the opportunity to work with a bank like them, a bank that is incredibly innovative, a bank that has done very well in terms of creating products that in many cases actually show D2C brands how to do it, which is not something that you can say of other banks, at least not established ones. And a bank that actually operates in a market that I wasn't very familiar with. Most of my experience had been across EMEA. And the US, and they have a very strong presence in Spain, of course, because that's where they're headquartered, but across Latin America as well. And so for me, it was a great opportunity to learn, to get close to the client as well. And I think what I get out of this experience will only make me much better able to develop agency product that actually brings it to that next stage of what we need to be doing as an agency. So I think the agency model has lost a little bit of shine over the last couple of years, but there's incredibly talented people. There's incredibly strong relationships between agencies and brands. And I think we need to be proud of that. And I think we need to also understand the value that we need to generate for brands in a new context. And this is a phenomenal opportunity for me to try things out.
So it sounds like a good example, actually, of a sort of legacy brand, if you like, being able to teach DTC and digital first brand something, because you talk about the sort of pace of innovation at BBVA being really pretty impressive. And then it also sounds like you're saying you're getting that opportunity to reimagine that agency-client relationship, which you'll then presumably be able to articulate elsewhere, and this will sort of bring some lessons to bear for future roles, and will help to craft the way some agencies interact with their clients. And you talked a bit about how, you know, there's some really good examples of how agencies are working very closely with their clients. Are there some particular things that you've learned in this role that really stand out in comparison to what you've done before?
Well, I think generally what I see established brands that are evolving do very well is that they challenge themselves to go beyond their category. What do I mean by that? They don't compare themselves to your stereotypical competitor set. They are emulating companies that have changed the standard. I was mentioning retail earlier, you know, with an Amazon really changing the overall experience, right? And making, for example, same day delivery in some markets or next day delivery in most others, the norm. And I think when I see successful companies, when I see established brands that are making that transition, what they are doing very well is that they're taking the good from any other vertical, any other industry, any other type of player out there, and really thinking very, very hard about how they can apply it to their context, rather than limit themselves to their direct competitor set and do more of the same. And so I think that's a lesson worth mentioning. And I think it's a lesson that I would say, you know, I'd like to think as an individual, you know, I'd like to apply as well. So see what can be learned from others, so you don't make the same mistakes or you actually accelerate the pace of evolution. So it's very interesting to see established brands taking that on and thinking of themselves through a different rubric.
Seeing themselves in a different lens as
exactly.
well. Not necessarily seeing themselves, like you say, as just that brand, but seeing themselves as competitive in a much wider marketplace, which is not even within just that vertical, because, you know, that is the world of digital consumption that we live in, right? And it's really interesting, isn't it? Because we were just talking about this with respect to actually ride-sharing platforms in Southeast Asia. We were having a conversation about Grab Taxi, which, of course, bought Uber in Malaysia. And originally a Malaysian company. They've also just completed another fundraising round. But they offer so many more services than just ride sharing, right?
Yeah.
So they offer financial services, they offer sort of personal administration services, paying bills online, those sorts of things. Very similar to, I suppose, how WeChat have set themselves up in China. But it's this notion that you can start a company, have a company that delivers a service, but you don't necessarily need to be just thinking about that one service or that particular vertical. You need to actually be broadening your creative sensibilities to think about what else you could be offering the customer and where else you could be looking to provide useful products. Yeah. It's a different way of thinking.
Absolutely. I think what most of these companies tend to exploit are either inefficiencies in a market or points of friction with a consumer, right? And so when you can marry the two, you have huge growth potential. And I think the setup from a digital point of view allows you to pivot very quickly, which is what a lot of these companies do. So that constant, I'm going to test this, I'm going to see how it works, and then if it doesn't, I'm going to move on and do the next thing, I think is quite important, because the space keeps shifting, consumers keep changing, right? And I think it's far less starting that perhaps it was many, many, many years ago. I wouldn't know because I wasn't around, but but I think it's absolutely key. So I think when you marry those two things, right, the opportunity to really make the experience much more seamless for the customer, and when you're tackling an inefficiency in the market, then you have that scale. And obviously it's not as simple as just that. You have to have the right leadership in place, the right product, the right distribution mechanisms, etc. But I think those two are quite key in that foundational stage, and that's what you've seen in many, many of these cases, right?
Absolutely. It would be great to hear more from BBVA directly. We were chatting about this earlier on. Hopefully we might get them featuring at our ATS Madrid event coming up soon in May, because it would be great to hear their perspective of how they're digitizing things and how they're handling the growth of their business from here onwards. I think that's it for this week. Thank you very much, Ruth. It was delightful to have you here in the studio. Thank you very much, Lindsay.
Thank you.
That was the Mad Tech Podcast.